That little hymn that I sang at the beginning of the service was a song that our family learned at our first Unitarian Universalist congregation, which was in the West Shore Church in Cleveland, Ohio, on the west side. And we were trying to find some little ritual element to include in my daughter's bedtime ritual, as we were trying to weave together this faith that we were discovering with our daily lives a little bit more. And there were various bedtime songs that they had in this little booklet, but she didn't really like any of them. The song that she wanted to sing was the song that they sang at the beginning of Sunday school. Not really a lullaby at all, kind of meant to be a little here we go kind of song. Open the door, step right inside. Come into this place where love and hope will abide. Reach out your hands, I'll welcome you in. It's so good to be together again. Now go to sleep. You know. And it's like the family song now, and I love it, and I don't get to sing it very much anymore. Aaron's often going to bed at a different time than I am, my youngest child. But it's been running through my mind, if you will, as I've thought about this morning's topic, which is this notion of hospitality. But not just hospitality, something we're calling radical hospitality, which makes it sound maybe a little scary or a little more serious there. It's a phrase some of you may have heard. There have been some books on this concept lately, and it's been a way that a number of different religious folk are thinking about how to root ourselves. People who are interested in diversity might talk about radical hospitality. The liberal churches that got small and white and well-to-do talk about bursting that open with radical hospitality and so forth. But it's actually a phrase that comes from the Benedictine order, from a monastic tradition. So what I want to do today is talk a little bit about that concept of radical hospitality. It comes out of the Benedictine community. And put it in conversation with our way and see if there's something in that notion of radical hospitality that might help us live better lives or something like that. So radical in this case for me means it carries all of the connotations of the word radical. When you think of that word, what comes to mind? If you're not a mathematician, I guess I might say what comes to mind. Maybe something, you know, right on the edge, a little bit dangerous, pushing things really far. It also means, in its etymology, and this is very important, to the root. So a radical actually is somebody who wants to, maybe they want to really transform things, but usually the idea means they want to get back to some perceived root or origin or form of purity. A dangerous impulse at times, but something to be said for it. At others. So radical hospitality right down at the very root. And this concept of hospitality that we're taking today from the Benedictines is a very ancient one out of the traditions from which the Benedictines themselves grew. This is one of the major themes in the Hebrew Bible. It's one of the major themes in the New Testament. And that's certainly where those Benedictine folks picked it up, so we need to say just a word about that. In the Old Testament in particular, there's lots of stories and lots of negotiating about how to treat strangers. And that really is the core of this notion of hospitality, is welcoming the stranger. That's welcoming in and everything that might connote. And in the times when the hospitality codes began to be written, when people really elevated this notion of welcoming the stranger to an ethical priority, was when people lived in these very tiny, you know, groups of people, a little tribe or something. The people that essentially wrote the Hebrew Bible were primarily pastoralists. They had large fields. And they would live in these kind of multi-story houses that would house maybe one particular family, but also all of the families under that, children and in-laws and slaves and people who had been contracted for periods of time. That would all be a household. But there was no law to speak of, no cops who you could call, depending on what was happening. You live out there with your folk and you take care of each other. And one day the fella up on the top of the house says, "I see people coming." Now, in that context where your nearest neighbors might not even be in view, here come strangers. and an elaborate ethical and code of honor developed to make that as safe as possible. You had to have a code that said, if we stick out our hands and shake hands and say, I'm not going to draw my weapon tonight, I'm one of yours, you're in, that was perhaps the most binding social power of that ancient world. Now, by the time that comes along, and by the time, excuse me, that develops over time, and by the time Jesus comes along, he's growing out of that tradition himself. He's got that whole welcome the stranger, love your neighbor thing already because of his Jewish heritage. He pushes those boundaries a little bit. There's cities now, and there's inns, and that need to rely on a stranger for your hospitality, as well as the desire to meet them and get news and so forth, that's starting to change a little bit. You actually can just go rent a room. And so Jesus pushes it a little bit farther and says, that's well and good enough, but we have now a different kind of community building, a different kind of hospitality that we're going to do, reaching out specifically to poor people. And to sick people, and to people in need. It's one thing to welcome somebody into your house who, not going to hurt me. Another thing entirely to deliberately welcome somebody who's that much more alien to your experience. So, and of course, he had some of his most inspiring words. Many people, even who don't really pay a whole lot of attention to Jesus, love these notions of. As you do unto the least of these, you did unto me. That idea that you might find in even the most broken and needy person a glimpse of the divine, Or as you clothed and fed another, so you clothed and fed me. And particularly in those early days, when the early Christian community believed Jesus was coming back any minute, they took those words literally. Like, okay, he said any beggar might be him. So we've got to go out on the streets and grab beggars and bring them to church and feed them and take care of them. And, that changed over time, of course, as the due date of the second coming kept getting pushed back indefinitely. That's major. We'll talk about that some other time, but things change. And they change because in an effort to survive, the church gets connected to the establishment, and it becomes in some ways the church of the wealthy and the powerful, and that original vision that it's for everybody, particularly those who need it the most, begins to break down. And it's at that time that monasteries develop, and that's where our Benedictines come from in a nutshell. Starting around 500 BC, many of the leaders of the church, or not BC, excuse me, after, yeah, naturally, begin to say that this establishment church isn't going to work. This isn't it. We need to go off into the woods together and live in an intentional community as a family. And the whole Benedictine name comes from Benedict, who was the founder of the movement, and he wrote a very famous text, Benedict's Rules, which are really just this tiny, simple little how-to manual of how to live in a monastic religious community. And it is the center of their work. This thing is still read today, and it's read by lay people. It's read by Buddhists who want to learn how Christians do their monastic work and so forth. And it's lasted all this many years. It's probably the most successful monastic movement in the West. Start out with the rules, and they almost seem random. There's just do this under these circumstances, do that under those circumstances, and so forth. But the heart of the matter is it begins with a series of exhortations to lead a holy life and the benefits that come from that. And some of those offerings that the rules make are very appealing to us. You will have an open heart. You will be more gentle. You will live in a state where you know you have enough. And some of those exhortations don't ring so true to our ears. You should live in terror of hell. You should do all of this in your longing for eternal life. But the basic point is that you have to root yourself first and foremost in your deepest intention, in whatever it is that you name as servable and larger than you. The very first thing is to love your neighbor as you love God and love yourself. Then there's all these instructions about how to do prayer and offices and so forth. But the rule overall can vary a couple of key points that have interesting parallels to the Unitarian Universalist way. The community is autonomous. It's those folks out there in that monastery who are living the rule together and creating it and putting it into practice together. And the main practice, the main way that they live the spirit that they're trying to evolve in themselves is through the welcoming of guests and the tending to the sick and to the needy. Hospitality. That's why monasteries were the first hospitals until that was taken over by the state in like the 1600s and 1700s. Hospitals, that was religious practice. Okay. Now, there are, of course, big differences between a Benedictine monastic community and a Unitarian Universalist community. I won't be unrealistic here. But the heart of the matter is a call to put into practice a very brave stance, a very risky stance that they would call radical hospitality. This idea that from intentionally living in community together and working together and abiding by principles together and putting it to the test together, that a state of freedom is achieved where you cannot help but want to share that with other people. And so the doors to a Benedictine monastery are always open. Anyone who comes can stay. If they're going to stay too long, they need to question their commitment and possibly move toward joining and so forth. But sick people, poor people, anyone who needs to come, the highest ranking monks drop what they do and bring those people in. And in order to do that, in order to have the strength to do that, to open the door and whoever's there, think about that. Say, come on in. Let's find out about you. Let's find out what we can do for you. That's a really scary thing to do. And we need to kind of be honest with that and name that. If we want to pursue a path of radical hospitality, of finding the holy loving power in our interactions and our embrace of other people, we have to start that work with ourselves. And we have to confront those fears in ourselves that keep us from reaching out to other people. And I might even say that keep us from reaching out even to ourselves. Using that image of a house again, if we think of our own selves as being a house, I wonder if I'm the only person who has a room or two he prefers not to visit. Or the storeroom, you know, the basement, you know, and so on. Well, if the image of hospitality is that the windows are open and the sun is coming in and the doors are open, that means we ourselves first have to go around the house and be willing to open those doors and embrace those parts of ourselves that we don't want to welcome into our own lives. And that is very vulnerable. That's a scary thing. That's that scaredness we feel when we think of the idea of just saying, come on in. And I was trying to think of an image to capture that feeling of how vulnerable it is. And my thought was, imagine your house for whatever level of neatness you normally enjoy, its worst state. Whatever that means for you when you're like, you look around and think, I've lost control of my life because of the look of your house. At that point, whoever that person is who shows up to your house, who makes you feel even worse about it, like your dad or your mother-in-law or your neighbor who never seems to even drop anything on the carpet, let alone need to vacuum it up in the first place, that person comes open. And you have to open it and say, come on in. I've got microwave French bread pizza for dinner tonight, you know. If that thought makes you like, oh, then we're touching a little bit of that fearful spot that we need to attend to in ourselves. So one thing I thought is, if you can remember that little song, that's not just something that we say outward to other people, open the door, step right inside. That's something maybe we can even hear from in ourselves, to ourselves. And this gets rid of this whole notion to think of hospitality as like a Martha Stewart performance, okay? But hospitality is not supposed to be yet another thing that we need to be better at, you know, or prove something by, or demonstrate from our perfect aesthetics how truly welcoming we are because we have the right glass and so forth. And don't get me wrong, I love the right glass, you know, but that's not the point. When we gather together, then, we try and take that spirit of hospitality that we might find when we imagine ourselves in our own home and bring it together for something that we think of as our home, as our house. And that same temptation to think of how we're welcoming people or how we're doing together, that same temptation to be perfectionists or to think of the need to welcome people and integrate new members as a problem, or to worry, like, is the church good enough? Are we big enough? Are we doing things right? How are the numbers tracking? That's that same thing in our heads that might keep us from saying to a neighbor, you know, we're just having spaghetti for dinner, but why don't you come on over and sit around the table? And that's a little closer to the heart of what we're looking for. And, you know, that's a decision that each person has to make for themselves, that I'm going to stop heeding that voice and reach out. Because I can sit up here and preach on being hospitable all day long, but there's absolutely nothing I could do to make you hospitable. I was talking with somebody last night about the hospitality industry, and which I worked in for years and years. And the notion that if you just create a corporate system that's sophisticated enough, you could make even, you know, a trained monkey seem like a good waiter at the end of the line, you know. And so you go to some chain restaurant, and the person comes up and gives the whole, would you like to try one of our special appetizers tonight? Because it said in some guidebook that that was the way that they should be inviting you to the feast, you know. There's nothing that can replace the person that just comes up and says, hi, how you doing? You know, and suddenly you have a relationship and the door opens. It's not something you can teach. It's something you have to choose to move toward by, as Benedict says, finding the deepest thing you serve and opening your heart tirelessly and fully to it with real discipline, real attention, practicing humility in an effort to really be humble and watching what you say. Those are the basic Benedictine rules. The rest are details. So one beautiful thing about coming together on Sunday mornings is that we give ourselves a place to practice this hospitality. And here, I think, with worship, we practice that first part of making the space for ourselves and welcoming in what we need to in order to be back in that place where we can then turn and say, hey, friend, come into my life. Let me know more about you. Let me learn from you. You can let go and just be yourself. Fine, I talk too much, I'm selfish, I'm this, I'm that, doesn't matter here. Here I'm in my community and I'm going to be me and I'm going to say, here's me, let me have some of you in our house. That phrase got rattling in my head, in our house. And the contrast popped right up. It's an Oakland Raiders commercial where they say, not in our house, but... not in our house. Now, that's cool as far as it goes from the football perspective, but that is so not what I'm talking about. The idea that if you go to the Raiders' house for a football game, some guy in a skull thing is going to pulverize you and holler you out of there. No, in this, it's like we've got some kind of different, incredible, bizarre game, maybe a little like Quidditch or something like that, something chaotic going on in the middle, and we say, no, yes, in our house, yes, in our house. Practice it. When you go out there for coffee afterwards, you just look around and you find one person who's of a different age than you are. And then you find somebody who you know really well, and after that you find somebody you don't know really well. And one thing you can say is, what'd you think of the service? You have just shared something that I hope would yield at least 5 minutes of small talk. Okay. The ready topic is at hand. That's practicing listening more than talking, those two simple things, how'd you like the service, and listen really deeply, you're opening up doors to enlightenment left and right at that point. We have to assume that everyone that walks in the door, everyone, on a Sunday morning in particular, whether they look like someone who spent the night on the street, whether they have light skin or dark, Whether you've known them for 20 years or just 1 hour, they're on a journey of some kind. They're the stranger coming over the hill. And we can choose how we want to live at that point. You want to reach out a hand and put the swords down? I guess I do. It feels internal, you know. It's a sacred thing that we do here together in community. And sometimes there's this fear, I think, that if we think of our work as too inward, and it's, of course, it's a balance. The idea that establishing a really vibrant, welcoming, friendly community, doing that internal work, that may not seem like spreading the word about Unitarian Universalism. That might not seem like getting out there and inviting people in necessarily. But I would just say, consider the success of the Benedictines. By just going off there in the woods and deciding to live together, there are now 1,400 different associations of Benedictine monks around the world. They're independent. They transcend Catholic and Orthodox and Anglican boundaries. They're credited sometimes with saving Western civilization during the so-called Dark Ages. The rule contains proto-democratic elements. There is one person in charge. There's portions of this we'd have to be very careful with, but that person is to heed the word of the entire group. That was revolutionary in the church at its time. So doing internal work, living with discipline, rooting themselves in welcoming the stranger no matter what, rooted in a sharing of spiritual perspectives and so forth, that thing grew and grew and grew and grew. And today it remains a remarkable, nourishing source of spirituality for many, many people, myself included. I think we can do something like that. When I go back to that compound image I began with, more and more people, yeah, okay, come on over the horizon. Come on into the compound. We're just going to have to make it a little bit bigger. We'll stretch that wall out. We can add a wing on over there. Not because we now have more people to fight off the folk that we're scared of in the distance, but because every time we add another wing onto this house, we open another gate and we open another doorway so that more and more strangers might come over that horizon to us. Not more walls, more gates. The words say, open the door, step right inside. Come into this place where love and hope will abide. Reach out your hand. I'll welcome you in. It's so good to be together again. Without getting up, I'd like you to, those who are right around you, end by reach out to them and say, love and hope. Say it like it's a toast at a wedding. Serious, but joyous. Love and hope. Give that gift to the person next to you.